Welcome to Afternoon Bible Study. It is, again, such a pleasure to be with you guys here. This has been a really, really fun week for me, and now that most of the board has left, I feel like I can completely slack off and we can just have a good time. No more work done. We're just going to read stuff and joke about it. But actually, I saved one of our hardest questions for today, just in approaching Act 4 in the way that I've sort of planned our conversations this week. Act 4 is the act in which the church finds itself. We've heard the story of creation and fall, we've heard the story of Israel, we've heard the story of Christ, and now here we are, and we don't exactly have a script laid out for us. But nor are we totally on our own. We know how the story has gone up to this point, and we know how it's going to end. We have assurances, and our job is just to sort of play in that open space and be faithful to the story that stands around us. And so the question is, what can Esther mean for that story? In some ways, Esther shows us a model of improvisation, just because the Jews in this stage of their history are already sort of improvising. They've suffered through the exile and the destruction and burning of the temple, so it's no longer clear what script they're following. The temple sacrifices can't be made if there's not a space to make them in. So how does one be a faithful child of Israel in this period? It's not really clear. And for those who like the Old Testament to sort of lay down very clear rules and positions on this sort of thing, it's either very freeing or very disappointing to find out that there's not sort of a set answer to this. There's actually a very open conversation going on. And what I mean by that is you get different kinds of stories from this sort of late era of Old Testament writings. So you'll get the story of Ezra, who is roughly contemporary with Esther, and just as obscure, so appeals to me as a book and potential Bible study, but he's just not as much fun. But what happens there, Ezra, this priest in Israel, sort of, you know, reads the Torah to the assembly and has this nice Reformation thing moving on, sort of moving people back to the idea of following the commands of Torah. And it's very, very nice. But one of the things he gets to that sort of epitomizes this position, if you get as far as Ezra 9 and 10, there's the conflict of, should the Israelites who have been exiled, who have undergone the diaspora and really moved out into other parts, should they really be intermarrying with other folks? And in Ezra 10:3, they say, "So let us now make a covenant with our God to send away all these wives and their children, according to the counsel of my Lord," by which they mean Ezra, "and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law." So you see this kind of idea that, well, to be Jewish, to be Israelite in this period is to be holy and set apart still. And you kind of find that in Esther as well, in Haman's accusation that we read in chapter 3. There are a people, and they are separated, and they do not abide by the laws of the king. They have their own laws that they follow. But that's not the only voice that we get. There's another late story that might not strike you as late, because Christians put it pretty early in the Old Testament canon, and that's the story of Ruth, who is a widow and marries a good, upstanding Israelite man who's sort of a distant relative of her husband who had died. But she herself is not an Israelite. She is a Moabite woman. And so it's kind of this answer to the, oh no, Israel needs to be set apart and holy and other and totally distinct. You get this story of a woman who is, by that rule, really off limits, but who is, wonderful and gives us those great words about, where you go, I will go, and, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. I have a friend who's composed a beautiful musical setting of that text that we just love to hear at weddings especially. But, you know, aside from giving us beautiful words, that book concludes with her being an ancestress of David. And then a couple generations later, more or less, she's an ancestor of Christ. So that's sort of an answer to that, no, Israel must be pure and separated theology, with a teaching that actually, as the people of God, maybe, rather than exclusive and holy and set apart, Israel might be a beacon or a bridge for those of us who are still reflecting on Kari's Vespers from last night, to the rest of creation and the rest of the Gentile nations. So totally irrelevant question for Christians, right? Whether we should be set apart or very inclusive and open and embracing. But it's a question that these later books in the Old Testament are really dealing with. And the question for us is, you know, whether Esther is sort of coming down on one side or another, or really what she's showing us about improvising during this period of Jewish history. And I will say, we get two hints, and we've already come across them both in chapter 3. I mean, one is Haman's accusation. We said, right, these people are living, they're separated. They are not living according to our culture. They're living according to their own thing. But chapter 3 closes with verse 15, where the city of Susa is totally thrown into confusion by this decree that the Jews should be destroyed. Which suggests that actually the Jews are fairly popular. There's, you know, they're living peaceably with the surrounding culture, and it doesn't make sense to everybody what Haman has against them. So there seems to be a clear distinction in Esther. There are enemies of the Jews, to be sure, but there are also Gentiles who are not their enemies. And we'll find out what happens to both of those parties in chapter 9, probably tomorrow. But so again, the question for us, watching Esther and her people improvise in this period of Israel's history, what does this tell us about our improvisation as the Christian church? Ultimately, what can we take from this very strange, sometimes silly, sometimes horrifying story? And the short answer that's sort of been given by the Revised Common Lectionary is not much. Churches that follow the Revised Common Lectionary get to Esther once every 3 years, and they read, we'll get to it in our study today, because what they read from is Esther chapter 7. A couple verses here, a couple verses there, and then they skip to chapter 9. And read 3 verses. So it's a very chopped up bit of Esther. The question is, what do we do with it? And the short answer, again, is not much. But again, you know, whether you were thinking of preaching on Esther to a Christian congregation, or just dealing with it as part of the Old Testament, part of our, you know, canon that we consider to have revealed God to God's chosen people, what do we do? So with that question in mind, let's turn to chapter 6, where we left off yesterday, which is just one of the funniest darn things to happen in all of Scripture. This is another one that's really hard to read with a straight face. And Haman is in here a lot. And I think we can go ahead and bring back the traditional practice of blotting out the name of Haman and Amalek from all memory, which means if you see his name, even if you're not reading, well, especially if you're not reading, feel free to hiss or jeer or whatever you like. But this is a good fun story that we can definitely enjoy. Let's start with just the first verse to remind ourselves where we are.
On the night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of records, the annals, and they were read to the king.
Okay, on that night. Now, we're picking up directly from chapter 5. And what happened at the close of chapter 5 is Zeresh, Haman's wife, gave him this awful advice to, well, I know what you can do. Go ahead and build a gallows, and we'll have Mordecai hanged on that for this slight that he's given you of not wanting to bow down in your presence. So it's on that night. The king could not sleep. So immediately, you know, Zeresh has said, go on and tell him something in the morning. Well, here's what's happening at about the same time. Meanwhile, in the palace, the king could not sleep. And again, we mentioned there are variations. I mean, the translation that we're using in these Bibles is based on the Hebrew rather than, say, the Greek Septuagint or the Latin Vulgate. And as such, we have this sort of passive, okay, the king could not sleep, doesn't tell us very much. But the Greek actually says, that night the Lord took sleep from the king, which is a little more overt that, you know, this is divine providence happening. But even folks who don't necessarily, you know, read the text that way literally tend to read it that way figuratively, that this is an instance of God sort of coming into the narrative and arranging some things.
May
to,
the spirit disturb you.
May the spirit disturb you, yeah. All right. Let's go through... Do we want to do the whole chapter in a chunk? Let's just do verses 2 through 4. So what's going to happen that night if you cannot sleep?
And it was found written how Mordecai had been told about...
Just give it a best shot.
And Teresh.
You have to be very brave to read in this room.
Two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands upon the king Ashereth. Sorry.
You're fine.
And the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. Through four?
Yes, four as well.
And the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court and the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him.
Now it's not clear, thank you, it's not clear the timeline we're exactly following here, but if everything's happening immediately, then... You know, it is evening, this gallows idea has happened, and that night, meanwhile, the king could not sleep. Did he wait until morning to call for the annals? It doesn't necessarily say. But if it's still night, then Haman has not followed his wife's advice of going in the morning. He's just there in the middle of the night. so he's really eager.
Extra creepy.
Extra creepy enemy of the Jews. All right. Now he's just entered to speak to the king, and he doesn't know that the king is looking to honor Mordecai for this service that he has done in the past. I wonder if that's going to go well. Let's read verses 5 through 11.
So the king's servants told him, Haman is there, standing in the court. The king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what shall be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor? Haman said to himself, whom should the king wish to honor more than me? So Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king wishes to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse that the king has ridden, with a royal crown on its head. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let him robe the man whom the king wishes to honor, and let him conduct the man on horseback through the open square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor. Then the king said to Haman, quickly take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to the Jew Mordecai, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and robed Mordecai, and led him riding through the open square of the city, proclaiming, thus shall it be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor.
Boy, that's foreshadowing all over the place.
Isn't that nice? What do you mean, as far as...
That's like how they paraded Jesus, and...
Yeah,
that's what I see. Mm-hmm. You know, mocked him, king of the Jews.
Sure. Yeah,
and at the end of it is the gallows or the cross.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think I mean, it's hard to say exactly what is going on here. I mean, Daryl actually really helpfully brought that up for us yesterday, just as far as, well, is this, you know, does the author know? And we don't know exactly. But yeah, those images are really, really striking for somebody who knows the story of Jesus suffering. There is a gallows, a great hanging instrument hanging over this text. And somebody, a Jew, is being paraded through the city. There's a horse wearing a crown, by all appearances, first stated there. I mean, the Hebrew
my
is just...
My little pony!
Yeah, the Hebrew is just funny. I mean, with a royal crown on its head. It seems that the horse gets to wear the crown. It could be the person who's riding it, but it's sort of textually unclear. So the translators helped us and just made it a joke. That it's going to be the horse gets the crown. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's very, very significant. And of course, what's interesting is this great reversal that, you know, the this honored person is supposed to be, you know, executed in Haman's mind. But in fact, it's evil that is destroyed that day. Spoiler alert, at the end of the text, Mordecai doesn't get what Haman hopes is coming to him. Another interesting echo that's happening here. So the king says to Haman in verse 10, "Quickly take the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so to the Jew Mordecai who sits at the king's gate." The Hebrew phrases actually, it's just in slightly different order. It's do so to Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. So it seems a fairly insignificant change that the English translation has made. But there's a parallel midrash. There's a midrash on this verse, and there's a parallel one for Genesis 22 when Abraham is told to take his son, his only son, whom he loves, Isaac. And the idea is that Abraham is being asked to do something very, very difficult in that verse. And so the reason there's so many descriptors is because there's actually a full conversation going on. And God is saying, you know, Abraham, take your son. And Abraham responds, well, I have two sons. And God says, your only son. He says, both of them are my only son, because they are the only son of their mother, whom you love. Well, I love them both. And then the devastating Isaac. So Abraham sort of stalls in the Midrash, doesn't really want the difficult response. And Haman has a similar, if darker, but also funnier, problem. He's getting a response he really doesn't want. So the Midrash goes that the king said, you know, go and do the same for Mordecai. Oh, there are many people named Mordecai, the Jew. There are many Mordecais among the Jews who sits at the king's gate. And that's the hammer falling. And he realizes that he's going to have to do this horrible thing that he was hoping was going to happen to him. And in fact, he's going to have to... he's going to have to do this for his arch nemesis that he's just decided arbitrarily is his arch nemesis. If we turn to Genesis 41, which we don't have to right now, but Pharaoh's investiture and ritual parading of Joseph when he gives him a lot of authority has a lot of sort of parallel images with this text. So that's another tie between the Jews in this story and the patriarchs. Joseph this time. But Penny wins as our medieval exegete of the day, because there are also Christian writers in the Middle Ages who are going to identify Mordecai as Christ and say, look, he's on a pony and he's going through the city and there's all this, you know, adulation going on. It's Palm Sunday. It's a shadow of Palm Sunday. So if I had a crown, I would give it to you. All right, let's finish the chapter. Let's see what happens to our characters here. 12 through 14.
Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom your downfall has begun, is of the Jewish people, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him."
Huh. She's changed her tune. And she seems to know, I mean, Haman always identified Mordecai as a Jew, so it's not like she should have just learned that he was Jewish. It's just weird. I have no explanation for this. But ominous, if nothing else. He's of the Jewish people. Oh no.
She's like saying, "You're a goner."
So this is Law and Order, you get that.
Yeah, exactly. The movie soundtrack kicks in. But it gets more ominous still. Penny, go ahead and give us that last verse, 14.
While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman off to the banquet that Esther had prepared.
Oh, this is closing the snare. All right, chapter 7. So now we get to the little pieces of Esther that have actually made the cut and gotten into the lectionary. So year B could be your moment. In the autumn months, it's just a Sunday after Pentecost, Esther 7 is paired with a couple of other readings to be the Old Testament lesson. You only get a chance once every 3 years, so I hope you've been taking notes and stuff. Alright, so what we read as the church from Esther is verses 1 through 6 and 9 through 10 of chapter 7. It'll be very interesting. We can really pick on the people who put together the lectionary. Oh, what are you leaving out? All of the good parts, aren't they? And then it skips. There's a little coda that comes from chapter 9. Which we can flip to, but let's see what's worth including and learning from here from Esther. All right, let's hear verses 1 through 6.
So the king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. On the second day, as they were drinking wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have won your favor, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me. That is my petition. And the lives of my people, that is my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have held my peace, but no enemy can compensate for this damage to the king." Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he who has presumed to do this?" Esther said, "A foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman."
Yes.
Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen.
All right. So there's drama there. It's not random. It's a pretty climactic moment in the story. So it's not a totally silly bit of the text to choose, but it is a pretty isolated bit. Interestingly, so this who is he and where is he? There's a professor at Harvard, John Levinson, who has written a much better commentary on Esther than I've been giving you this week. So look him up if you remain interested. But he suggests that this who is he and where is he? It's not just the pronoun he. It's the Hebrew word ze, which is just kind of a dismissive. All right. Who's the jerk? Where's the jerk? I mean, that's kind of how he suggests it be translated. He actually uses guy to convey the derogatory sense. But, you know, the king has no respect for anybody who would do this to his queen. So that's what we're dealing with. This is the first chunk of the text to be learned from. She is fitting into an Israelite narrative, for sure. If I have won your favor, this bold direct address. It's a change from the way she's addressed the king before. We've seen her say before, if it pleases the king, you know, a slightly less direct form of address. Now it's, if I have won your favor. I mean, this is echoing Moses, you know, in Exodus 33. If I have won your favor, if the people of Israel have won your favor, you know, the darling of the sovereign is risking his own life and his own favor to sort of stand in the breach on behalf of the people who have screwed up royally. In Moses' situation, it's the golden calf thing.
To me, it seems like this is a big key moment. Like, mm-hmm. will she be able to speak the words? Will she be able to actually ask this thing that's been asked of her?
Yeah.
So I'm sort of like, yeah.
Yeah,
she did it. You know.
There's the brief calamity.
She did a good job.
Right. There's the brief calamity of, will I be executed on site entering into the royal chamber? And she gets mm-hmm. past that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, absolutely. We've been set up for the climactic moment. She's been holding off, and now, all right, this is what's going on. And see how he responds. If I have won your favor, and if it pleases the king, let my wife be given to me. So this is where we find out that that Esther's, if there was a mystery, I mean, Esther is not Christ. She does lay her life on the line, but she is not, I mean, she escapes the snare. Ultimately, our story is of a Messiah and Savior who lays down life only to take it up again, but he doesn't escape. Nevertheless, brave lady. So what does the lectionary skip? What happens here in verses 7 through 8 that we're not going to read in church? I wonder if it's dirty. Uh-huh. 7 and 8.
The king rose from the feast in wrath and went into the palace garden, but Haman stayed to beg his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that the king had determined to destroy him. When the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman had thrown himself on the couch where Esther was reclining, and the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?" As the words left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face.
Well, the Jerusalem Bible says it rape her?
Like raising the question?
That's what it says there, you know, in front of my eyes.
That's how
what it says.
Wow.
I was reading that this morning. Oh.
Yeah. It's a slightly more pointed translation of the word that gets rendered in the NRSV as assault. Okay, I understand not wanting to necessarily have to explain that bit of the text from the pulpit for the, you know, the kids that are still in the room and things like that. But what you miss when you cut this out, there's Haman has thrown himself on the couch, is how that has it, which is what I've got in front of me. But the verb that's actually being used here is the verb for to fall. So he's sort of fallen on the couch.
Has he collapsed?
Well, I mean, I think the sense is that he's sort of thrown himself at her mercy.
Begging.
So yeah, begging and things like that. So in that sense, the translation makes sense. But the word that's being used that sort of has that range of meanings in Hebrew, but just not English, so they've helped us and given us thrown himself to fall. I mean, that's a word that's been used throughout the text. I mean, the lots fall, and Haman is going to have a downfall that Zeresh has depicted or predicted because he's picking on a Jew. And things like that. So that fall echo gets lost if you take this verse out. But yeah, Haman's really sealed his fate here. The king might just be being mean at this point and deliberately misunderstanding his position. But I mean, assaulting, making a move on the king's harem in this point in history, that's total usurper activity. I mean, that's making a move on the throne. That's something, when one of David's sons tries to overthrow him, the first thing he does is take all of his father's concubines. And it goes predictably dirty from there. Books of Samuel, they're fun. But, yeah. So we miss the falling. All right, well, where does the lectionary allow us to pick up? Verses 9 and 10.
Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, "Look, the very gallery that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose words saved the king, stands at Haman's house, 50 cubits high." And the king said, "Hang him on that." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the anger of the king abated.
I think it's...
I like a good hanging to abate my anger. Once in a while. Who is Harbona, and how does he know this? I mean, not a whole lot of time has elapsed from the advice, "Oh, build a gallows," and then Haman going into the king to say, "I've got this gallows," which he never gets around to saying. But then he's parading Mordecai. He's directly rushed off to a banquet, and over the course of that event. You know, all of this transpires, and it turns out he's going to be hanged now. So who is Harbona, and how does he know? There's, you know, one suspicion that commentators have had is that this is downright backstabbing treachery. Harbona knows because he's friends with Haman, and now that Haman has fallen in favor...
He probably helped build it.
He probably helped build it, exactly. He knows exactly what it's used for. I mean, he knows not just, "Hey, there's a gallows in front of Haman's house, let's use that," but it's the very gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai.
Who saved the king.
Whose words saved the king. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Harbona knows which side his bread is buttered on, and he knows it's not the Haman side anymore. So total treachery going on here.
Maybe he's one of those friends that Haman came back and and with his wife, you know, and
all of my honors. Look how many sons I've had.
Yes, he bragged doesn't fail.
But then coming back and lamenting what had happened to him too, because he did the same thing.
Indeed. So those are the verses that are going to get read in church one lonely Sunday in year B in the autumn months. If there's sort of time in the church services to have all of the lessons, including the Old Testament one, or Purim, yeah, exactly. Just talking about Christian churches that take a bit of Esther once every 3 years. Purim, I mean, the Jews are going to be celebrating this every year, and reading the whole book really lively, hissing at Haman's name and things like that. But the coda you're going to get, just to jump to chapter 9, so again, we've got chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, skip the awkward raping the queen thing, obviously, and then the conclusion of Haman being hanged for his treachery. And then the lectionary asks us to read chapter 9, verses 20 through 22, just those three verses in isolation. Does somebody have them turned to, or I can read them? Well, Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, enjoining them that they should keep the 14th day of the month of Adar, and also the 15th day of the same month, year by year, as the days on which the Jews gained relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and presents to the poor. Mm-hmm. What we've skipped is that, we'll find out in chapter 8 and the rest of chapter 9, is that actually getting Haman executed and hung doesn't change the fact that the king has allowed an edict to be written and sealed with his royal seal, and the king's laws in this setting, in this story, are not alterable. So Haman may have been executed as the traitor to the queen and the royal family that he was, but that doesn't change the fact that we're dealing with a real threat to the Jews. And the way Esther and Mordecai are going to solve it is going to result in, violence for violence. And we'll get to the specifics of that. We've got a few minutes, so we can get a little into the violence. Oh, goody. But when the Jews are delivered from their enemies, it's not quite as simple as just executing the one guy that orchestrated the whole thing. About 5 minutes. Okay, well, maybe we'll start with chapter 8 tomorrow and we'll hear about violence upon violence then. But I am curious, now that you've heard the lectionary reading, how does Esther speak to the church? The coda from verse 9 is nice. The enemies of the Jews have been destroyed on that day. Is this a text that can be read sort of historically, literally, let us celebrate this thing that has happened? Or do you sort of feel like automatically making the move to, enemies like sin and death, you know, and the destruction of those things? Is this a text that, you know, it needs to be spiritualized? if it were you stuck facing down the pulpit, you know, a week or two hence, where would you go? What would you think about?
I got a question too. What about that thing in verse 4 where it says, if we've been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I have held my peace. Yeah, I'd be happy with that.
Who's happy with that?
Yeah.
Fair question.
Well, I think she's being clever because, you know, she's like, first she ensured that if he was, you know, she was favoring him or he was favoring her, and then she says it, if we had, you know, been sold merely as slaves, I would have held my peace, but no enemy can compensate for this damage to the king. She's, like, speaking to his vanity as much as, you know, he's been, like, a buffoon in this whole story. Like, even though he's saving the Jews, he's the one who allowed the edict to be decreed in the first place,
right.
And he's a
drunkard. This is what
happens
when you hand your signet ring
over
to whoever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I think that it's a lot about, you know, I think that the vanity and the bragging and all that stuff is, like, one of the bigger sort of, like, moral lessons in the story because, you know, Esther is sort of realizing that and using it to her advantage.
And using it to
these people. Advantage. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fantastic. All right. So she's allowed. She can do it.
Yeah. Like, forget that this guy is trying to, like, perform a genocide. Like, how could anyone damage the king in this way? You know, like,
right.
That's what she's
right.
using to make
she knows how this works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you kill me with the axe, you're going to get blood all over yourself.
What?
I wonder what the other texts are in the lectionary for the day, but...
Oh, sure.
One that kind of would be preachable, I would think, would be... the corporate nature of what Esther's doing. Like, she's not just petitioning on behalf of herself, she's petitioning on behalf of her whole corporate body, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that is actually, that is a way that Esther gets appealed to in the tradition. Particularly Catholics love to see Mary in Esther because Catholics, better than Protestants, have an understanding, or at least differently from Protestants, have an understanding of Mary's sort of intercessory role, being close to her son. So Esther as intercessor is a very clear parallel in a Catholic mind to Mary as intercessor. And so the idea, for example, there was a friar named Cardenas in the 17th century in Peru, who made an appeal to the king of Peru, who was, of course, just the king of Spain at that point, to fund education for the Andean people, folks who live in the Andes, sort of the indigenous population. And in his letter, this was a fun thing to come across in the Esther commentary, which of course I found it there. I mean, I didn't do that much research, I just looked at a commentary. But he said, you know, King, to his king, you know, do this, can't you hear Esther crying for these people? He actually sort of makes an appeal to the story. And so that's, yeah, a thing that Esther does sort of on behalf of this whole body. Definitely. No, definitely that's there. You mentioned other lectionary texts, and I do have them. And the clearest one to go with this story is the psalm for the day, which you're really lucky if you also get the psalm in a church service. But it's Psalm 124, and the way it goes is, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side, let Israel now say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side when our enemies attacked us, then they would have swallowed us up alive when their anger was kindled against us. Then the flood would have swept us away, the torrent would have gone over us, then over us would have gone the raging waters. Blessed be the Lord, who has not given us as prey to their teeth. We have escaped like a bird from the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken, and we have escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. So that's one of the texts that gets paired with this, which sort of plays up that deliverance theme. For sure. And so then the question becomes, well, how do we understand deliverance? How do we preach deliverance? From what enemy? What enemies have been placed under our feet? That's a good set of questions. All right, now I have run out of time to have fun with you guys. But tomorrow, the climactic ending. What's going to happen with this edict that has been published against the Jews and that's still there, even though we've managed to get rid of Haman? How will Esther convince the king? Will she convince the king to change an unalterable law? And how does one do that? The epic conclusion of the Book of Esther. Tomorrow, if you're not too busy preparing for the parade.